Hello, everyone, and welcome to Horrorsperia. My name is May, and today we have an episode on Black horror history. This episode is really special to me for a number of reasons. Black history is personal to me. I was raised by an American Black man, and I come from a mixed-race colonial background that I won't really ever know the roots of. Black history and horror cinema was something I educated myself through Dr. Robin Means Coleman's seminal masterpiece, Horror Noir. This book has now been turned into a documentary and is credited for starting a movement of quote-unquote elevated Black horror within criticism and output. But for me, this book is a historical cornerstone. Black history is Black horror. All of our lives, whether we are American or not, whatever that means, Black or not, we are touched by Black history. Black history shouldn't have to be personal to you for you to draw a connection to it, you know, whether you have roots to the Black diaspora or not. And in my horror class, I have based a group project on Dr. Means Coleman's book, where the students are divided into decades. I try to do a themed episode for every lecture in my class, but I wanted to do more for this episode is not only show my students, but the film and horror community and anyone that really listens to this, that our history is not behind us, right? It is actively being built and influenced in our current moment, which is something we've seen reflected across the globe during the pandemic, especially. That means that we have to uplift voices currently working in the movement and not wait to give our roses to artists after the fact, especially when it comes to the Black diaspora. And so for this episode, I have a talk with one of my favorite Black genre filmmakers, Nikki Yatu Jusu. She's a friend and a colleague, but most of all, she's a visionary who is set to go into production on her first feature film this year. We talk about Black horror in general, but I love this talk for how we both place ourselves within the context of the work that's been done and the work that there's left to do. What I love especially is Professor Jusu's remarkable insight as to how she was able to grasp her personal voice within genre film to use genre as a metaphorical tool for the history she comes from and the history that actively lives around her. But before I play the interview, what I want to do is I want to give a brief history of Black horror, and all of my facts are based on Dr. Means Coleman's book. It is a remarkable piece of writing. Whether you're an academic or not, I just think it's a really fun read. And so I do just want to lay out some facts. That way you all have sort of like a historical timeline for how to place our discussion. So to begin, there have been Black filmmakers from the advent of cinema in the late 19th century, but due to Jim Crow laws and a number of political and social interventions, Black filmmakers did not either have access to equipment or venues to make or show their films. And so whenever there were depictions of Black people in early cinema, it was usually white people in blackface performing offensive stereotypes. There were Black filmmakers in early cinema doing their best, like Spencer Williams and Oscar Michaud, but the preservation and accessibility of these films then and now pales in comparison to their counterparts. In the 30s, horror became a household genre with the rise of pre-code cinema and the Universal monster films. These films didn't star Black people, though the output during the 30s is highly influenced from a colonial lens with several jungle romances and appropriation of Haitian culture, which at the time, Haiti was being actively colonized by the United States. They were occupied there. King Kong would soon come in this era, and that very figure of King Kong remains a racist reference still in our modern media. And then in the 40s, World War II showed these colonial stereotypes expand with films now taking place overseas and Black culture remaining a devalued property within this framework. And so there's this film, I Walked with a Zombie, which is a good example of this, that shows the white female protagonist engaging with what Hollywood coded as Black culture with their appropriation of voodoo and having her white womanhood threatened as the conflict in that film. Race films didn't have any white saviors. They had Black people starring in films that reflected Black reality and saving themselves from the oppression of colonial and racist hegemony imposed on them. The 50s and 60s is marked by a general invisibility of Black people in genre cinema. And so we see the retain of racialized monsters, such as Creature from the Black Lagoon and The Leech Woman. What makes this all more insidious is how anachronistic the cinematic atmosphere was to reality. In the 30s, when Black people were being played by white people in blackface, we had the Harlem Renaissance going on, which changed music and art globally as we know it. While the 50s and 60s would have you believe Black people didn't exist in America, or at least on screen, civil rights movements were changing the social and political landscape of America. This was omitted on the silver screen. It wasn't until 1968 with Night of the Living Dead where things really began to shift. While George Romero insists he never intended to make a quote racialized film, he ushered in the possibility of Black heroes on screen in horror films. They didn't have to be a stereotype. They didn't need to remain in Black-only worlds. They could now possibly take on the struggles of the world for everyone on screen. This led to the era of Blaxploitation. With the lifting of the production code in the late 60s, cinema became a free-for-all again. Grindhouses arose in the wake of exploitation cinema, and now cinema was more accessible, sexual, and taboo than ever before. The women's rights movement and anti-colonial fights overseas seeped on screen as Black genre films defined the decade. I could do a whole episode on Blaxploitation, and I think I will one day. But one trope that is not talked about too often from this era that I just want to bring up here is the enduring woman trope as coined by Dr. Means Coleman. It's a foil to the final girl trope, you know, white, virginal, the remaining savior to the boogeyman. Femininity embodied, essentially, right? Christianity, what have you. The enduring woman is nearly the opposite, highly sexualized, thus immediately her battles are different from the suburban final girls, specifically in terms of systemic oppression. She's constantly fighting off police, men within her own community, and the men exploiting those men. She's a soldier for all and a target too, including herself. Ganja and Hess, despite not being a Blaxploitation film, has a great example of this in the character of Ganja. Pam Grier, who is a Blaxploitation star, can also be considered the poster girl of this trope across the many roles she had. But if the 70s was a cultural explosion Black audiences had been waiting for since cinemas entered the public sphere, the 80s showed another step back into invisibility and a creation of problematic tropes. The irony is, the 80s also ushered in a new subgenre that would change horror as we know it, the slasher film. However, these slasher films didn't have roles for Black people. These were films in suburbia that signified white flight. The inner cities had become too racialized, and their utopia could only be found in the suburbs, which were now being adulterated by masked monsters. For the films that weren't slashers, there was a creation of the magical Black entity, the Black savior to white problems, whose only purpose was to solve and sacrifice themselves for the white characters in the end. This is a trope that is still liberally used today, though we can find its earliest traces in The Shining and Angel Heart. The 90s, though, signaled yet another bounce back for Black horror and a new subgenre, hip-hop horror. These were films that were set in inner cities and recalled a lot of the foils from race films. These were Black problems with Black saviors, with roots and folklore tied to Black traditions, whether that was in the modern culture or references to the mother culture. These are films like Tales from the Hood and Death by Temptation. Now, in the 21st century, such films aren't as popular as they were back in the times, but they helped set the stage for the Jordan Peele breakout in 2016. And so I want to end this brief history here to play the interview with Professor Jusu, though I want these facts to remain in the back of your mind as we explicate themes from the past and present in regards to the work horror has done and still has left to go. Nikki Atu is an artist that is working through these themes while also exercising her personal voice through some really great work and some deep references to things that honestly haven't been as cinematically depicted before. And I think it's a really rare opportunity to hear someone through that and to get their perspective. So we thank her so much for taking time out to do this. I hope y'all enjoy. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Horosperia. This is May, and today we have, this is like a pod that I've been wanting to do for the last few years, but I haven't had the time or opportunity, and the person I wanted to do it with me has always been very busy because they are kicking ass right now. Without further ado, I want to go ahead and introduce her. So please, everyone, welcome Professor Nikiyatu Jusu.
Thank you. What an amazing welcome, May. Thank you. I keep remembering this is voice. They're not going to see us, so I can make any face I want.
Yeah.
But thank you for having me.
Like I said, the main audience for this podcast are our students. So a lot of them are already familiar with you, but I do have a bit of a wider net. So for those of you that may not be familiar with your work, could you please put into your own words, like what you do, you know, the spiel?
I'll try. I'm a fiction filmmaker. I'm specifically navigating horror right now in my work. And I create films about women protagonists, specifically Black women protagonists, who are living on the edge in various genres. So navigating rage and some of the darker elements of characterizations of Black women in genre.
That's awesome. And so you have done quite a few shorts. You graduated from NYU, right?
Yes, grad film, NYU.
One of those shorts went to Sundance in 2018, right?
2019. And it feels like 100 years ago. But yeah,
two years ago. I met you like I think a week after you got into Sundance. So that tracks.
I remember around the time, May, that it was like a flurry of stuff happening at George Mason too.
Yeah. And the very first image I have of you, I'll never forget it. You had your braids right now, but they were up in like an updo, and you were drinking this 2-liter bottle of Deer Park. And I just like, and it was the cool like handle bottle. And I was like, oh my God. I want to do that. And I like tried doing that for a week. No lie. And then I was like, oh, this is cumbersome. I can't do it.
I'm trying not to like make sounds because I know this is a podcast.
No,
I'm like laughing internally, but yes, that was not sustainable.
You don't do it anymore?
Now that I'm in my home, I'm just like, drink, please find one little mini, like just try to get that down for the day. Like the water intake has changed, but yeah.
Beautiful image. So Suicide by Sunlight was part of the dramatic shorts competition, right?
Yes.
Yes. And Suicide by Sunlight is up on YouTube. And why don't you talk a little bit about that piece?
So Suicide by Sunlight has had a long journey. I originally, mind you, I've been working on this concept for like 8 years now. And so started as a web series, and then it evolved into a TV series. And that's where it kind of stuck for like a few, I was trying to figure out how to get it greenlit. Mm-hmm. You know, delusion is a hell of a drug, but it's also really beneficial in this industry. So it's important to be delusional in your youth. I was trying to figure it out, got nominated for a grant called Through Her Lens, which is via Tribeca Film Institute and Chanel, the brand. They nominate 5 women filmmakers every year. And so these 5 women now have to pitch a short film concept to a panel of judges. They have celebrity judges every year. And for my year, it was like Mira Nair, Rachel Weisz, the actress. Anyway, every year they have celebrity judges. And so you have to pitch a short film concept to compete for like around 90K to make the short, which is a lot.
That's a lot. It's
a lot of money for a short. We won our year, and we ended up I decided to make a proof of concept speaking to a larger series as opposed to writing a brand new short. It didn't make sense. I already had something I was stacking. And Suicide by Sunlight was born.
Yeah, it's funny that you say that because I could definitely see how it works like a pilot pitch, even though it also works as its own complete piece. But, you know, it does open so much wider with the world, especially through its mise-en-scene and all of the cutaways with the other vampires. Like, you want to know their story. But yeah, so Suicide by Sunlight, it's really great. Why the vampire?
I didn't even pay homage properly. But Octavia Butler is a writer whom I have been infatuated with since undergrad. So I was exposed to Octavia Butler's canon in undergrad, just like a professor noticed my taste and just recommended this graphic novel. Then I went down this rabbit hole of this woman who was creating worlds where Black women were at the epicenter of fantasy and sci-fi and horror. And I had never seen that before. Like, I had never seen someone who looked like me creating characters who look like me in the worlds that I gravitate to. And so Fledgling is one of Octavia Butler's novels that I read some time ago. And so based on the concept, there's a hook in this story. And anyone who's taken a screenwriting course knows that a hook does not mean equal plot. A hook does not equal story. And so the hook was daywalking Black vampires who don't burn because of their melanin. And it was like, how many layers, there's so much you can do with that. Yes. You literally can create so many franchises off of that hook. And then I went down a rabbit hole of different cultures and their vampires. Like, Trinidadians have their vampire, Nigerians have their vampire, Sierra Leonean. Like, if you dig deeply enough, you can find that the vampire lineage exists in almost every culture. And so it didn't feel disingenuous for me to take Octavia Butler and think about Black vampires and try to create something altogether new in the canon.
Yeah. And, you know, one thing that I really love about Suicide by Sunlight is that even in its 17 minutes, there is like this folkloric sense embedded in its mise-en-scene, especially through the evocation of the priest, right? It's a priest.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And how that especially works almost like its own montage theory. And like I said, it contains so many layers, and that's what really excites me about your work. You know, this piece, that this podcast is kind of trying to address the whole of horror history, but a lot of, and so I'm going to get a little bit on a pedestal, sorry.
Good. I love it when you do that, May.
No, but one thing that kind of bothers me with the recent wave, like the post-Pelian wave, even though, you know, like, thank God it happened, you know, and whatnot.
Getting started.
Right. But it's like this throwing around of the term elevated horror and you know, now Black people are at the echelon. And first off, elevated horror, Black, white, whatever, I hate the term, because to me it implies that horror is not
elevated.
Well, elevated and like speculative enough, or even you know, political enough, radical enough, when it's pretty much the most radical genre, you know. It was created out of a post-war movement, and it continually, through its authors, especially Black authors, it continually has been redressing horrors that mainstream culture, the hegemony, just doesn't, you know, address. And so, but what I kind of have enjoyed from the post-Pelian wave that I feel like has not been getting enough credit is are voices like yours, where it's like, it doesn't have to be like this Black trauma or this elevated thing, or I don't have to try to make the Black version of Hereditary, or I don't have to try to like shoehorn slavery in my movie. It's just, you know, Black people, especially the Black diaspora, you know, has so much folkloric, they as you said, they have their own tropes. And I love that your work is exploring that, you know, because those are the voices that have truly been silenced since the beginning of the cinematic industry, you know?
It's true. May, I would love to take your class. Goodness, I could only imagine. Like, I saw the clips, but like, you're so good at this. I agree. I think horror is you know, something we, you know what, I, it's weird because I have one foot in the industry and one foot in academia. And so yeah. they're antithetical in some regard, you know, and it's like, okay, so I have to use Black bodies in this pitch, but like in academia, I would not be caught dead using Black bodies. And then I have to talk about elevated horror and the elevated horrors that this is similar to in my industry pitches, because people are so myopic and their imaginations are very small. And what people don't understand is that in the industry, people are not, you would think, actually, maybe if you're paying attention, you wouldn't think, but the execs are not watching that many movies outside of America or even in general. You're having meetings with people who don't have the language, like the filmmaking language. And, but they don't, nobody gives a shit about that in the industry. Yeah. And so, yeah, there's a canon of elevated horror that is everyone is trying to duplicate, specifically when it relates to Get Out. Everybody, this we're in like the post Get Out era, but it's scary because like everyone is trying to duplicate it, and it's really disingenuous the way that it's trying to duplicate it.
Absolutely, especially because that story tackled just one aspect of, you know, it's like, could you imagine if we talked about horror like the post Nightmare on Elm Street generation?
Can you imagine?
Like, no, because like that wouldn't be a thing, you know. And we've had so few experiences, and one, so the whole reason, so I guess, okay, I'm like saying five different things. Let me kind of talk about the project and my goals with it. So I think you've read about it before, but so when I inherited this class, Black Horror was like 2 weeks, and it was like Night of Living Dead, Get Out, which obviously great, but I became a teacher to push those limits. And I, you know, you and I were just at a panel of one of our colleagues where it was said that the texts that we were taught were upholding white supremacy. And if we're to be, especially as non-white people, if we're to be true to the pedagogy that a 2021 student body deserves, it's being as anti-racist as possible, but also being, you know,
absolutely
reflective of the things that matter to us. And you know, I've told you this before, but I grew up with a Black family, and so like when I entered this class, I was like, I don't, you know, I can't do Black horror history in 2 weeks. And so there's this really great book by Dr. Robin Means Coleman, who wrote Horror Noir, and she
Horror Noir.
Yes. And she lays out the entire cinematic history of essentially Black people, because it's focused on horror, but it goes all the way from the beginning. And you can see how there were interventions with Black filmmakers that, you know, I also teach intro to film history. And one thing that I get is a lot of my students feel like Black people just didn't try making films in the beginning of like only white people were trying to make films in the 1900s. And it's all about shattering that, right? And so with the, and this is sort of the only group project that my kids do throughout the semester, but I assigned them into decades, 30s, from the 30s to the 21st century. And they each have to choose a different aspect of Black horror and Black history to research during that decade. And then I have them all present their projects online. Like they all have to submit. Usually they can do like video essays or papers or websites. Like they can make their own websites. I've had such creative projects roll through there.
I can imagine,
Yeah. And, but the reason why I love it is that it actually creates like this Black cinematic history, horror and non-horror.
Right.
And so my whole point in doing that is because there are just so many forgotten filmmakers that even their work struggles to survive. You know, like whenever I think of like the real trailblazers for Black horror, and again, no shade to Jordan Peele at all.
But yeah, I think of course not.
Like Bill Gunn and Ganja and Hess, who probably like, made the most political genre film of its time.
Yes.
You know?
Bill Gunn was way ahead of his time.
Beyond, yeah. And the whole story of Gong Jin has how like he was given the money to make a blaxploitation film and he purposely went behind their backs to make the film that he wanted to make about addiction and the African American experience time. It's just like, damn, like he was, and I mean, he paid for it. Essentially, that film was lost for 20, 30 years.
And the ways that he had to navigate, like Bill Gunn, I'm glad you started with Bill Gunn because that's who I found my way to in rediscovering the Black filmmakers who have paved the way for me to make what I'm making now. And I found my way to Bill Gunn and I was like, oh my God. That's why I don't like it when in the industry, you know, the few tokens that this industry chooses to be mouthpieces for the entire, this myth of a Black monolith, don't speak to the previous Black creators who have navigated these. You know, they're very proud about having a diverse palette. Yeah, like, I know about the white filmmakers, but that's not, if you're really aware of what this system looks like and what it means to you and your legacy, it's not a bragging right to know the white filmmakers. Like, that's a given. That's right at the surface. That's easy. That's the lowest hanging fruit. P.T. Anderson, Quentin Tarantino, Wes Anderson. Yes, I was raised on that in film school. And so the Bill Gunn, like when I discovered Bill Gunn, I was just like, oh, I'm not original, May. I'm like, I don't know if his like spirit was speaking. He was like, you know, I need someone in this generation to kind of do what I was trying to, like, it's just like, oh my God.
Yes.
The themes that we're navigating, I just was, my eyes were really open. And so, you know, the Spike Lee remake, I don't think paid it justice, but like Bill Gunn really was approaching filmmaking as an auteur, as an intellectual. And we don't talk enough about that or, you know, in the mainstream.
I know. I agree. Especially because Gong Jin has been restored, but 90% of his other films are still lost.
Yeah.
Bill Gunn was, I discovered him in my route in trying to build more about this, but you know, it's just the proof that there were these, you know, quote unquote elevated themes being played around the entire time. Another one that I think of is what Oscar Michaud had to do to elevate himself against the era of D.W. Griffith. In my intro to film history class, I tell them I don't teach Birth of a Nation, but you can watch Within Our Gates. Within Our Gates is up on YouTube, and it was the direct response to
Birth of a Nation.
By the Library of Congress. The Library of Congress preserved Within Our Gates up on YouTube. I make my students in the second week watch it, but I do it because, hello, that was just the response to Birth of a Nation. And I really balk at histories that are like, oh, but we have to learn how racist we were. We know how racist we are, not we were.
Right.
You know? And it's like, we need to study the dissenters. You know, because dissent wasn't created in the civil rights movement. You know, it wasn't created with the Black Lives Matter movement. It is built upon, you know, generations and generations of dissenters in creative industries, especially trying to, and, you know, a lot of the tragedies that a lot of them have been silenced. And the fact that we know about, you know, Oscar Michaud or Spencer Williams or Bill Gunn is through a lot of luck and a lot of organizing. And so I feel like you're absolutely right. It kind of, you know, it's not like we should always have like, well, we got to name drop all these people that way people know that we about it. But it's just kind of like we should naturally reference those peoples in our works and the research that we do, because they were the ones that really challenged the hegemony, you know?
Yes.
And
agree.
And that's how we can go further with it, you know, rather than staying at this superficial, like you said. I love that you brought up the point that you do have to play along this industry line that you would otherwise advise against students, because a lot of that is just a survival for you to dig
it's deeper a different
into
game.
The system.
It's a different game, and it's a game with its own unique language, in the same way that academia is a game with its own unique language. And are you well-versed in these languages enough to get fluent quickly? You know, it's like, They're slightly different languages within the same paradigm of white supremacy and patriarchy.
Absolutely.
But they are different, you know? And it's, so it's like, with Birth of a Nation, May, like the D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation, again, similarly, I mean, all of us are learning that as like filmmaking 101, intro to filmmaking. So many of these professors don't have the range to navigate that and talk about it in a way where it's like, yes, we're watching this. No, we're not perpetuating that this was okay or is still okay. They just don't have the range to even, they're not self-aware enough to talk about what it means to introduce that as an introductory film. Yes, it's racist. It's like, that's, if you're lucky, your professor even acknowledges that.
Right. And it's just funny because it wasn't, you know, it wasn't even the first epic. Like the first thing it had was that it was like the first film screened at the White House. And I'm like, I'm really glad that that's what we do. One of my, so I teach that at the community college. And this was just a few weeks ago when we were discussing Within Our Gates and Birth of a Nation, one of my students went, this is the sixth class where I thought I was going to watch Birth of a Nation, but we didn't. So he had watched it five other times in classes. And that's what I mean. Like, they always think it's necessary. It's like, you thinking it's necessary makes another person think it's necessary. It's not necessary at all. Like, people can get it without needing to be subjected to it. But, you know, so I guess to kind of, I guess, find a focus. I mean, there was just all of this. There's always been the struggle of Black filmmakers trying to do, you know, anything. And it's so anachronistic to what Black culture was actually doing in America. Like, you know, you think of the Harlem Renaissance in the 30s and how there's practically no cinematic evidence of that era that changed culture, period. You know, and that was That's in the 1930s. Crazy. You know, we had sound films by then. Birth of a Nation had been 20 years since then. And no one was there. Instead, what we had in the 1930s were things like King Kong, things like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, which is one of my favorite pre-code films. But every single time I watch it, I just can't, like, I can't divorce how coded ethnically the monster is. And it's just things
every that single time, yes. Every single time.
Yeah. And, you know, it not only does, do exclusions like that make me think of where film history has to go and what we should uplift, but it also makes me think of what's not being caught now, you know, because I don't think that we're still out of that anachronistic intent, you know.
No.
It had to take, you know, this summer of civil rights movements for all these corporations to do all of these really transparent executive moves. And you know, in some ways there have been, you know, you can see how the change in content is good, but it's still, you know, a commodifiable, you know, intent.
Yes.
So,
yeah. I mean, you're speaking to you know me, you're preaching to the choir, but it's like, not that much has changed. And so when the industry latches onto a film like Get Out, it's like, oh, this is so predictable, you know? And and when I say that, it's even worse than you can even imagine, because the duplicates are written mostly by white men. And so what's happening, I think, right now, and has probably happened, and not probably, I know for a fact has happened previously in different generations, is that we're in this wave where social resonance matters, and duplicating the last socially resonant thriving box office hit, Get Out, matters. But what still doesn't matter is nurturing new voices and nurturing actual Black voices or marginalized voices who you can't direct a Black person who is directing a white script, that is not a Black story. Okay. Exactly. And so the story originates on the page. And what I'm finding is that the duplicates of Get Out is white men still taking up so much space, and white people in general taking up so much space in trying to duplicate something that came from someone who navigated racism in a way that they haven't. And so the industry still doesn't get it. It's like, we have these two co-writing white men to write this script that feels like Get Out. If we tack on a Black woman director, that is going to make this authentic. So that if we try to take the fall in public, we can still point to our Black woman director. And it's a double-edged sword as a filmmaker, because the work that they're offering Black women filmmakers is so few and far between, one, and two, just so undesirable that they almost back you into a corner in this industry, certain demographics of filmmakers, and say, well, you haven't had work in 10 years, so do you want to do this thing? It's sad.
That reminds me of this movement in the 40s. So in the 40s, you know, Black filmmakers were trying to break into more of the industry. And so they organized a meeting with the NAACP and Hollywood execs. And this was a meeting that was like 2 years in the making, trying to address, you know, stereotypes in Black cinema, whether studio execs would up legislation like diversity rights, inclusionary writers that became really popular a few years ago. Essentially, that was sort of like the purpose of this meeting. And this was a recorded meeting, like the minutes are available somewhere. And the executives, so this is the 1940s, they were like, well, I think Black people should just be grateful that they get offered roles in the first place. Yeah. How is that different from what is told to
you? Yeah. It's not, and it's not different for the Black actors now.
Yeah, no, exactly. And it just puts all of the Black entertainment industry, whether they go along with it or they don't go along with it, it's, you know, they need a co-opting, you know, and it's like it puts, you know, Black people against their own identity crises. Yes. Like even watching the documentary for the book Horror Noir, which is up on Shudder. Yes. I remember when it gets to the 80s decade, they had a few actors that acted in the 80s. But the thing about the 80s is that it was a lot of the sacrificial archetype. You know, it was kind of sort of defined by Black invisibility, which I want to get back to in a second. But I remember a lot of the actors were like, I mean, I understand what you're saying, that we were killed first, but we were just glad that we were in those movies to begin with. Yeah. And it's like, how can you almost fault that? You can't.
It's you know what it is, Nate? It's not, the myth is the binary, is that like either you're a hater or you're like you're happy for other Black people. Like this is a lie, that this is the only two options. And so the system maintains itself because you support X Black artists, ex Black films every couple of years. And so the few Black critics get to critique a film where they really feel like they're spoken to, or at least attempted to be spoken to. And maybe you didn't quite think the film was, it's just like, it's a losing game. And tokenism.
It's like Rubik's Cube.
Yes. And tokenism is inherently supposed to pit us against each other and, you know, make, alarm us that resources are scarce, and so we're operating from a scarcity mindset. And so it's the same thing with the you know, Black American or ADOS versus the British Black British or Black diasporic actors. Yes. We're all operating from a scarcity mindset. We're punching at each other because we're the lowest hanging fruit, but we're not punching enough at the system that pits us against each other.
Right. Yeah. I forgot what philosopher it was. He was, I'm going to hate myself for this, but I had to read him last semester. And he was talking about how in order to solve this crisis of pitting us against each other, you know, the black nation needs to look at itself like the Black diaspora, like that's the nation to be loyal to. And that resonated so deeply, you know, because especially coming from such a colonized place and like not even knowing where my, you know, where even if I'm supposed to put upon, it's just kind of like, I just believe in this like floating plane where we're all just kind of like we all need to solve this together on this plane. We can't bring ourselves back down here, because down here they created the situation down here. You know,
And that's where we linger. That's where we find solace. Right. But yes,
You're right. Yeah. So kind of on that note, I read recently this essay from Michelle Wallace, who's this visual culture theorist from the 90s. And the essay really resonated with me because she talks about how, you know, in Black theory, especially back in the 90s, like, there was always this talk of, like, you know, Black, these studies done by Black researchers being like, oh, Black children prefer white dolls, and that's because of racism, blah, blah, blah. And Michelle was like, she was like, but you're actually not reckoning with what's the problem. The problem is Black invisibility. It's the fact that Black people are not in advertisements, are not on TV. You know, of course, you know, that doesn't prove racism. That just proves that, you know, we're in this white world. And how are Black people going to relate to images that they don't see?
Right.
You know? And so I bring that up because not only because we also said that you kind of found Black horror a little bit later on in life, but like, how do you feel like mediating, especially, you know, as a Black spectator, but also as a Black filmmaker, like, where did you realize that you could be your authentic voice? Or do you feel like it was always down there with you?
So if I understand the question.
Sorry. Yeah, I was kind of like,
no, trying to... I understand that. I want to make sure that I'm answering the question you asked.
Yeah.
At what point in this trajectory of being kind of aligned with Black horror did I realize that I could tell the stories that I wanted to tell without like the pretenses of the industry?
Yeah, or even, you know, it doesn't need to even be, if it was at the filmmaker stage, okay, but maybe when you were younger, like,
okay.
I guess that's why I brought up the Black invisibility part, because I do think that that was, I know that we're only about a couple years off, but like, when I think of Black horror, like, the first thing that I would have to think I thought of was Candyman, which in and of itself is very, you know, tied up in a lot of...
I see what you mean. Like, what film was I introduced? What film did I see the beginnings of what I could have, like, didn't know I was ultimately going to start working within?
Yeah. Or maybe you already operated within the invisibility. Cause I guess that would be my answer. Like, I thought that I was supposed to be invisible.
Oh, okay. I get it now. That was a good example, May. Okay. So you know what? I'm lucky because I never went through a period where I was like, this is supposed to be the way it is. Like, I don't see that many Black women who look like me. If I do, they're usually biracial or an admixture. And that's all to say, like, my mother's biracial. So to some degree, I'm multiracial, but I never felt like it was what it was supposed to be. I always had a nagging feeling, even though I was raised in a multiracial family and a very African family, meaning that when they got to America, they kind of, you know, perpetuated some of the anti-Blackness that they were conditioned to believe by aligning with whiteness. Even within all of this, like, I still always had a nagging feeling that I wasn't the problem, everybody else was. Like, this system was. And so I've been in predominantly white spaces my entire life, which is nobody, I say I'm lucky because I know so many Black people who, or people of color, people outside of whiteness, you know, people who are mixed, who internalize white supremacy. Like, most of the non-white people who I went to middle school, high school, undergrad, grad school with internalized that. And I was always gravitating to the people who didn't. I always gravitated to the people who had a nagging feeling that although they didn't have the language yet or they didn't have the references yet, white supremacy was just so insidious that we all believed this lie, you know? And so I think when I'm a reader first and foremost, like I entered artistry through writing and reading. Like, I was always a really good writer. I wrote a poem. I won an award in like middle school. And my parents were like, huh. And my mom is a writer. My mom self-published a novel called So Pretty in African. So I was a reader. So I, like, most of the stuff that I started to consume was fantasy, and I gravitated to like immigrant or first gen peep writers. So I had that, I had affirmation at home just by the very nature of being African, because that's what I was raised in. And then I had affirmation from the things I was reading. So I perceived education as my job as a youth. Like, I go to school, I'm with these white people all day. My white teacher says something really racist today, but it's fine. It's work. You know, this is my, I'm clocking in. Right. And then I'm going home and I'm getting affirmed. And I know that not everyone gets that.
Yeah.
And so I was lucky in that regard. So I never, I think Eve's Bayou, Casey Lemons, if I have to pick, nice. When I felt like it started to materialize, it was like, okay, this is, you know, this is how, but also like West African filmmakers like Usman Sembeni and Jibril Mambeti, like they were playing with magical realism. And I was I grew up with Ghanaian and Nigerian films. And so I, being first gen American, raised in a Black, in an African monolith in the South, has colored the way that I perceive my Blackness.
That's really beautiful. I'm so glad that you had that. Especially, I feel like so I don't have that strong of a family unit per se. Mm-hmm. And so that always, I always felt personally exactly what you described, but I didn't have anyone at home really breaking the reification, so to speak.
Right.
So I always felt like I was the crazy one, and I feel like it wasn't until that, because even undergrad, I wanted to cast all people of color in my films, and my producers only had white producers because I was the only, there were no Black people in my class. I was the only brown one.
Yeah,
they would be like, oh, no, you shouldn't do that. You should use this person, blah, blah, blah. And I would just let it happen. Mm-hmm. And like, it wasn't until I was able to get out on my own for my grad that I was like, oh, I can make whatever I want. And it doesn't, that's the point. Like, I'm supposed to change this invisibility around me. I'm not supposed to reinforce it. And I think it really is just because you need those people with you at home, though.
Yes.
Reinforcing that.
But you know what? It wasn't anything that was spoken at home. Like I had to educate my parents to some degree, mostly my mom, about like Black American history and why this whole pull yourself up by the bootstraps is a losing battle made to pit us against each other. Right. But it's like, I still had, nobody was saying it, but I do think there's something to be said about having ties to the continent that affirms that in an unspoken way.
Absolutely. Yeah. Even now with my research, I feel such a strong displacement still.
Mm.
And it kind of bums me out, but.
That's why, you know, you're lucky to, I will say that I think one of my roles as an educator is not just like teaching craft, but is guiding students to their authentic voices, because I encounter particularly, which one day I will talk about this more publicly because it's so interesting to me, Asian Americans, like when I have Asian American film students, it's just like their proximity to whiteness and being a model minority makes them not even see that they're erasing themselves in film school. And it's like, don't you want to see yourself? And you're constantly poking students like that. Don't you want to see yourself? You have the power to put yourself in the story.
I'm actually freaked out that you said that, because I just had an experience with a student in December. I had him a year before that. And exactly what you described, like it came time, it was for 255, which their video production class.
Mm-hmm.
It came time for that big final short project, and I strongly encourage, especially in that class, you know, like find the authenticity around you.
Yes.
Even if it's not what you usually imagine, you know, dig into what is your world.
Mm-hmm.
And so he made this really great piece centered on his Asian culture. And then in December, and it was great, but I thought that he did that all himself.
Yeah.
You know, like I didn't think that I you know, I know that I guided him along
you
the way.
You nudged him, May.
Yeah. But no, in December, I got this crazy email a year after we had spoken saying that, you know, you were the only professor that really told me to embrace the authentic voice. You know, I wouldn't be making the films I'm making without that nudge. And I'm just like, that makes me really happy and almost sad at the same time, because that is really what we should be nurturing. I don't want you all to go make militant films because I'm a militant, you know, or I don't want you all to go make, like, I want you to find what, because everyone would make something different if they were true to their own voice, because no one can be who you are. And so I really love that. One thing that I wanted to say is I'm also really grateful, even though like I had, and I still deal with such a double consciousness. Now more as a researcher than a filmmaker, I was always told that Black was beautiful. And I was dark. I was the darkest in my family, but my stepfamily was darker. And so like, I always felt like, this sounds so dumb, but I was like, I'm cool. Like I'm I'm not my biological family, because I don't need to be them. I'm really grateful for that, because especially when we pick apart Latinx racism and how, you know, like in a lot of ways I had to learn about that over the last 5 or 10 years, because I'm like, my family didn't view that, you know, like
I'm still learning
with Black people, you know,
I'm just like, you know what? Wow. Latinx people are like, they have the same shit that Black Americans have, that, you know, like that Africans have, like that this hierarchy of proximity to lightness and whiteness. It's real.
Yeah, it is real. And again, that's why I always, ever since I read, I think it's, Paul Gilroy. Ever since I read Paul Gilroy talking about the Black nation as the Black diaspora, I have never felt something that felt at least closer to that. Because
let me take this note, because I might need to read. What is it?
Paul Gilroy is the theorist. And he said, he wrote this book in the 70s on Black British culture, but he kept referring to the Black diaspora as the Black nation. And that's who we should be faithful to, because he was talking, especially, you know, with the Windrush generation and all of that. So like, what was it to be a Black British person? Because you got assimilated into that culture, but you're still Black. And so that's why he said we need to ascend from all of these continents, because we also got family in the Americas.
Everywhere, like, man. Africans, like we have family in England. We have family in the Caribbean. Like it's, we're everywhere. And so this is why I'm just weirded out that, and this is part of, this was part of the pitch for Nanny, is that in Nanny, you see these diasporic communities interacting in the film, because that's the reality of most Black people's experiences. Like, yes, there are microcosms where Black Americans only engage with Black Americans, or light-skinned Latinx only engage. Like, we're mixing and we're crossing, and we have Trinidadian friends, and we go to a Nigerian party, and it's like we're colliding and we're melding. And I don't see enough of that reflected in the content that we have in America.
Absolutely. One thing that I really loved about Suicide by Sunlight, and this can then tie into Nanny, is that, and I always mention this, it's also why I love Fresh Prince. Almost everyone in Suicide by Sunlight is not white. And I'm like, that always sounds weird, but man, it's like, that's just how it is though. You know, it always throws me off when like you see films made in Atlanta with all white casts, or if you see there's so many examples of those Get Out ripoffs that you were talking about. And in them, there's always one Black character among the sea of white, even if, you know, they have like one Black friend. It's just like, it's absurd. But that leads me to ask about Nanny. So you did Suicide by Sunlight. It did really well. You're sort of still reaping the benefits of that, but you're working on pre-production of feature now, right?
Yes. Yes. We thank you, May, for leading up to that. We got, finally got secured financing. We are two amazing production companies, Topic and Stay Gold, with some amazing producers. And, you know, Sundance really, I will say that Sundance kind of plucked me after I premiered there. And obviously they want to know what else you're working on, and then funneled me on this path from the screenwriter's lab to the director's lab to the producing lab with the same project. So they really want to see us win. But it's a supernatural horror about a West African nanny in New York City who is caring for a privileged white child in the Upper East Side as she prepares for the arrival of her child from her native country. And so this supernatural presence threatens to destroy and dismantle everything that she has created in America.
That is so great. Oh my God, I just want to see it now.
It's dark, but I'm pulling the creatures that we have. The reason why our budget is a little bigger, which it took a little longer, is that we're introducing West African mythology. So some of the supernatural figures are like Mamiwata and Anansi, who are two pivotal creatures in not just creatures, but like deities to some degree and figures to some degree, depending on the culture, who I haven't seen in American horror. And it just felt like a natural introduction to the American horror paradigm to introduce these figures.
And I love that you specify the American horror paradigm, because as much mm-hmm. as, you know, of course, I always feel like a bit of a third culture perspective.
Yeah.
I always do, you know, American film is American and we are Americans, whether we mm-hmm. like it or not. And I think that that is so important to show the multiculturalism of America. You know, you hear yes. the controversy right now with
Minari. Yes.
Oh my God.
It's driving me crazy because I'm just like, do y'all exactly. leave your home? Do you leave your house? Like, what the fuck? What the F?
Yeah.
You know, it's like somebody was asking about one of the CIA agents that was escorting Biden because he was Chinese American. And they were like, why does he have a Chinese? Like, where do y'all live? I mean, I know where you live. I do. Let me stop. I know where people live. But it's just like, to me, again, this brings it back to, I never perceived myself as the anomaly. I'm just like, what is wrong with you guys? Yeah. That you people, that you are not, that you're solely relying on media. That says more about you than it says about the people yes. you're stereotyping.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. And also to also tie back to a bit of that point about who is making these films. One of the first things I remember that you told me about Nanny, and it must have been probably a year ago now, is that you fought to have a Black female producer, right?
Listen, yes. my partner, I actually didn't have to fight for her for this project because she's been pivotal in me finishing. Her name is Nikia Molteri. And yes. she's been pivotal in me finishing this project and even just getting the script, I mean, and getting to a place where we have financing. But Nikia and I have together, May, navigated, like she produced Suicide by Sunlight. We've navigated spaces where we are very much the outliers in terms of being two Black women. Like I think a lot of Black filmmakers know the unspoken understanding or secret that if you have a white producer, it makes things a little easier in terms right. of finding financing. And so we maneuver a lot of spaces where us as a duo is a rarity.
And do you feel like you would be at this level without her?
No, no.
Yeah. No, it must feel like a safety, at least. Like, unless yes. you have one person in that room, you know, as you said, that you're always wondering these spaces and you know that you have to walk this line, but at least you have that one person in the room that has your back
and
has your back in lenses. You know, you don't need to break down the time explaining all of these cultural barriers. You could just, it's intuitive, I imagine. Yeah, right?
It is. And she's first gen. She has like a Jamaican and Cuban lineage and she gets it. And so what I will say, though, in general, like I know this is not a general film talk, but I in general, a lot of really talented filmmakers, all they're missing is a good producer.
Yes.
And then specifically non-white filmmakers, man, it's really hard to get attached to a good producer. And so, you know, the few who are lucky typically have had a white producer or have been yeah. maneuvering spaces where they might even align with whiteness in a way that has allowed right. them to have a white producer to help them make the film. But the producer variable is what is keeping a lot of really talented filmmakers out of the game.
Yeah, no. I mean, I can even say, even though I don't think I was meant to be a filmmaker, I think I really was meant for this research space. I feel that deeply because I feel like if just one person actually believed in me back then,
yes,
I could have made what I wanted to make. But everything happens for a reason.
Not so, too late.
I don't know.
I'm going to read your draft if you want feedback.
So to kind of begin to wrap things up and like take it back to like the starting point, one of the questions that I wanted to ask of you, because we sort of established that it's not like you were horror obsessed, so to speak. You were right. Inspired by Octavia Butler, and then you began to sort of turn into what black horror even is, or you know, right. Your space in it. Why stick with genre? Like, why not move into something else?
Well, I will say I've always gravitated to genre. So that's one thing I will say is that I've always, before I even had the language, I like darker. I mean, listen, we all know like everything is a genre, but when the industry says genre, we know it means like thriller, horror, action.
Thank you for saying that, because I always need to say that. So I'm glad that
is a genre. Rom-com is a genre.
Yeah, I'm right. Glad someone is saying that. That's not me. They know I didn't make that up.
Right. No, it's not. It's the darker, as May knows, it's the darker genres that typically get spoken out as genre. So I've always liked darker, even if it was a comedy. Like I remember Parker Posey.
Yes. Oh my God. I love Parker Posey.
I remember her being like one of the first white women where I was just like, oh my God, like there's something here. This is dark. I like it. I feel like I know these characters.
Party Girl, right?
Which one? When did I first see Parker Posey? It was in that, was it the brother sister? Maybe I'm like, no, that's not, no, that she wasn't in that one. Good Lord. But her, anyway.
Yeah.
I just like she was in a really dark romantic comedy. And I was like, this is dark. And I like it. So I've always liked genre. I think that Guillermo del Toro is very vocal. He's a Mexican filmmaker that you all should know, who's like a creature master. But he's always very vocal about he doesn't really feel like he's a horror filmmaker, but he just has always had an infatuation with monsters because he aligns with them and he's just always identified with them being an outlier for whatever reasons he felt like an outlier. In that same way, I've just always identified with the monster because, you know, the obvious reason is that navigating a society where you're not centered or where you're misunderstood, but I think it's bigger than, I think it's a spiritual maneuvering of the ways in which society like projects unsavory but true facets of humanity onto the monster. It's like you're projecting, you're deflecting, you're in denial. So I always saw the monster as the truth. And so as someone who's always gravitated to truth, the monster's just, to me, they're more compelling often than the protagonist, or they are the protagonist. They're just always compelling to me.
I want that on a shirt. The monster is the truth. That's so true, though. I've always that's always why I gravitated towards genre myself. It's beautiful, and I feel like. And the reason why I'm obsessed with it, I mean, my whole thing is using genre as a cultural studies tool. It's like, you know, there's so much you can imbue. Like I said, in Suicide by Sunlight, you know, the fact that they can daywalk because they have enough melanin, you know, that touches, you know, subjects of colorism, subjects of culturalism, you know, down to the folkloric aspect. Like, how does this differ from Western folklore? And like, there's just so many questions we can ask of film, because you know, even the Marxist philosophers from back in the day when cinema was first starting to be like a thing, they were like, this could be the revolutionary tool if we actually use it to expose what has been erased or what it's they're powerful. Trying to erase. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, just with the work that you're talking about, it seems like that's what you're trying to do. And I think there's nothing more exciting than to...
You know, May, I am a bitch is trying, bleep that out, but a bitch is trying. And because Lord knows at every turn of this industry,
yes.
somebody, and they oftentimes look like you, yeah. is just not prepared for the ways that you have really truly, that you are in love with your Blackness.
Yes.
You know, it is truly rebellion in any industry in this paradigm, but in particularly in an industry where imagery and sound has the power to convince people of things in the most palpable way, to really just feel good about your Blackness and love your Blackness and feel like it's a superpower. That is something that people fight in different ways at every turn.
Yeah, especially when it's codified that if you do show pride, that means that you're anti everything else.
Yes.
When, you know, when it's not the, it, no one
it's
else
projection.
Has to contend. Yeah,
it's
no
projection.
One else has to contend with that. Exactly.
Yeah.
And one thing that I especially find frustrating, especially as someone that can pass for so many different things, I've been called every nationality, and I don't ever get
offended.
I
can imagine.
Yeah, no. And so... But my shtick is always to fight for that voice as well. And yeah. you know, you have personal experience of some things that I've gone through, but it's something that, you know, like I said, I view myself more as being like a militant researcher and showing how we can use the research of art forms to help artists, but also to help how we can be better spectators. We can take the history of Black horror, which we've been discussing the themes and everything, and see like how it covers so many different things and how it doesn't relate just to Black people, how we can use this all for ourselves, whether we have Blackness or not. You know, it should, our proximity of Blackness should not dictate our closeness to it or our sympathy or even our you know, our identification with it. You know, there's so many things about being othered. You know, you can be othered in so many different ways. And some of us are othered in multiple ways.
Mm-hmm.
And finding solidarity again in that like playing together. I there's nothing more beautiful or powerful, I feel, or even more challenging. It's leading with love, not leading with you know, militancy, I guess.
Agree. There's a lot there. I mean, there's so much, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I don't want to keep you forever.
This is so good, May. It's always so salubrious. One of my favorite words.
What? I don't even know what that means. Oh,
it's
wow.
Like healing, healthy. Like it's always so
nice.
Salubrious to engage with you. I feel like I'm talking to someone within my tribe. So it feels good.
Yes, I feel I took a nap right before this and I was like, man, I'm going to be so bad at this, but this rejuvenated me.
You taught me something.
And honestly, like, I truly mean this, I'm going to try not to cry. Like, nothing is more inspirational to me than to work alongside someone that's actually doing the work that I want to be seen done. And you know that I actually don't, I'm not like super lovey-dovey with the rest of our call, but like when I say I want people to succeed, like when I say I want you to succeed, like it's like personal to me. Like your success,
May.
I feel like will be not only like my success, but a success for so many other people that need it too. So thank you for, you know, navigating
lot.
Those spaces, because I couldn't do it. I had the opportunity to try and I couldn't do it. And I am genuinely so proud of you. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. And I need for you to navigate the spaces that you're navigating, because I need someone, we need people to be able to deconstruct our work in a way that pays, that respects us and has reverence for our intentions. So
absolutely. And
the feeling is very mutual. Yes.
All right, my dear. Well, we're going to stop recording here. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And thank you, my dear. I had so much fun. You are
the
best.
Thank you, May.